private sin, it's also a public sin. And Allah, in general, we're told it's not going to be forgiven until we sort of make amends in a particular way, ideally through asking forgiveness of the person we spoke badly about. But obviously, I just want to mention one thing that Ibrahim Hadi would say. So he would say, so if he noticed that someone wanted to talk about someone else's flaw, he would say that no, we cannot, because we ourselves have at least 1,000 flaws. Welcome back to A to Z here on Arab English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And also I'm talking basically about backbiting and just minding our own flaws in general. So as I've mentioned, the martyr from Hall Defence, Ibrahim Hadi, who would say that, you know, we cannot pick up on the flaw of another person, given that we ourselves have 1,000 flaws. And we might, and this could be actually a useful task. Obviously, you know, during Qadr night in particular, we are support. One very nice task we do, or that we can do, is to, in a sense, ask forgiveness. And I remember so if you do this yourselves and literally write down all the sorts of things you did, you think you've done wrong, all your flaws, deeds or words, and we should not ourselves try to distinguish between these greater and minor sins and think, oh, but that wasn't so serious. I don't need to write that down. This is one of the big mistakes. We should never take even what we might regard as small sins lightly, because they're the ones that then might also lead us to greater sins. And that could also mean that we're a little bit arrogant in front of Allah, thinking that, well, you know, that sin, that flaw isn't so bad. You know, Allah will decide what punishment is due to us and whether we've actually repented properly for our sins. So maybe do this task. It doesn't have to be Qadr night. It could be any time. Because this just gives us an appreciation, like Ibrahim Hadi had, of how many flaws we have. And for sure, if many of us write down all the things we think we've done wrong, whether it's just in the last day or the last week, obviously we might surprise ourselves and might think, oh, there's so much that I've done. And, you know, and obviously, I urge all of us, if we're aware of things that we've done wrong, said wrong, best thing is to ask forgiveness of Allah as soon as possible if we become aware that we haven't. So, inshallah, this is a real reminder for all of us, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arab English Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to all the listeners from around the world. You are tuned in to Iran Radio for the next hour. We start this hour's lineup with a Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. Q&A on Islamic beliefs follows next. The program provides answers to listeners' questions about Islamic beliefs. Stay with us for the next hour.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. For decades, FIFA has hidden behind a cloak of neutrality. Keep politics out of football, they've said, while fining players for messages of solidarity and silencing protests for justice. But now, the mask has slipped. In a stunning act of hypocrisy, FIFA President Gianni Infantino has awarded his inaugural Peace Prize to Donald Trump, president of bombs, borders, and bigotry. The same organization that punishes a player for a slogan rewards a man who calls entire nations garbage, who fuels genocide, and whose legacy is one of global division. And the double standards don't stop there. While FIFA moved with lightning speed to ban Russia for what it considered the invasion of Ukraine, it has for years refused to even debate suspending Israel as it wages a documented genocide on Palestine. So what is FIFA's true game? Is it a guardian of sport or a political arm of American empire and its allies? In this Spotlight episode, we're not here to play games. We're here to expose them. But first, let's get more details in this report.
Players frequently face fines and bans from FIFA for expressing political messages, as the football governing body has long championed a policy of political neutrality. Yet on Friday, FIFA President Gianni Infantino awarded the inaugural FIFA Peace Prize to U.S. President Donald Trump. While presenting the prize, Infantino expressed support for Trump's international deals, including the so-called Abraham Accords that established formal ties between Israel and several Arab states without resolving the question of Palestinian statehood. Infantino has previously warned against using football to stoke division, saying that the political neutrality of sports should be protected. 2 years later, critics point out that he created a prize to celebrate peace and unity and then handed it to a president who called people from Somalia garbage just days prior and has advocated for increased military spending across the Western world. Trump also ordered the bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities in June and continues to arm Israel despite the ongoing genocide against Palestinians. Trump's administration has also carried out airstrikes against vessels near Venezuela. At home, the U.S. president has intensified an anti-immigration crackdown that has led to the detention and attempted deportation of non-citizens. Some advocates have been targeted for their criticism of Israel. A group of international activists who campaigned for suspending Israel from the world football have released a statement calling the award to Trump a shameful development. They also accused FIFA and UEFA of double standards over their failure to act against Israel in the 2 years of its war on Gaza, while swiftly sanctioning Russia following the breakout of the war in Ukraine in 2022. Infantino has refused to take action against Israel, arguing that football cannot solve geopolitical issues. The apparent preferential treatment of Israel calls into question the integrity of FIFA's supposed commitment to political neutrality, as FIFA continues to tout football as a unifying force on the global stage. It must now confront mounting accusations of hypocrisy and double standards that threaten its credibility.
Well, today we are joined by Mr. Ashish Prashad, political analyst and former West Asia Peace Envoy Advisor from New York. And Ms. Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief of MENA Uncensored, joining us from Beirut. Well, like to thank both of you for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. Well, let's go ahead and start off with our own coin toss, shall we? First of all, Ms. Khatoum, let's go ahead and start off with you. I mean, this Trump award. How can FIFA even claim this, quote, political neutrality is sacred, while creating a political prize and handing it to one of the most disruptive, narcissistic, ignorant, and racist political figures on Earth today? And just by the way, for our viewers, these are the exact terms and adjectives that Americans, his own people, describe him as.
I'm not surprised at all when it comes to this move by FIFA. At the end of the day, all of the international organizations are shooting themselves in the foot one after the other, exposing themselves, and the masks are off. FIFA is the most recent one only. I mean, if you had any doubt, the IAEA before it, the United Nations, you name it. Every single entity across the world that is headed by somebody who's appointed by one of the big five countries, then you have to think about it this way. They are at any point followers of one of those big five countries or all of them. And at the same time, they have to humor the Israeli occupation because the Zionist global lobby is very strong and it controls everybody, be it through the scandals they have on them or other secrets. When it comes to Infantino, whom we just basically naturalized as a Lebanese citizen because he's married to a Lebanese lady just recently, you have to understand one thing. This guy is, at the end of the day, a salesman. And he wants to actually, what you call, stay in power. The best way to do it is to have a network. So he's working as a marketing person. When it comes to Donald Trump, again, this person is the one who controls all the keys at the moment, a crazy person who controls the world. So at the end of the day, FIFA, which has so much bigotry against the countries that the Americans are enemies with or the Israelis are enemies with, then that's basically where you see FIFA distancing itself or basically approaching. When it comes to Russia, they were really, really fast in suspending its team. When it comes to the Israeli entity, they don't see, they don't hear, they don't say anything. And when it comes to the Americans, they will always kiss the hands and feet of the Americans.
Well, definitely, Ms. Khatoum, we're going to be elaborating a bit on that specific point later in today's program. Mr. Prashad, I'd like to go ahead and move over to you. I mean, if a player took a knee against Trump's policies or even wore a shirt criticizing his immigration crackdown, they'd be fined. What message does this specific crowning of him with a Peace Prize actually send to its own players when FIFA's honoring a president who not only embodies these characteristics but also has even mocked some of their home countries, such as those from African nations?
Look, I mean, it's, you know, firstly, thank you for having me. This is a truly shameful development, but it's not a surprise. I mean, Gianni Infantino, for the entire year, has been used by this White House to normalize their atrocities. Remember that, right? The biggest way to normalize atrocities, the biggest way to normalize the behavior, bad, good, whatever, of a nation, of individuals, of people, is to participate in cultural items, right? We've recently covered Eurovision. Obviously, football is the biggest sport in the world. And the White House has, you know, knowing that this World Cup was coming to the United States, has drawn in what my colleague Leila pointed out, a marketing guy who is nothing, wants the spotlight himself, frankly, as well. They've drawn in this individual to help them normalize the genocide in Gaza, to help them normalize this fake peace plan, to help them normalize any ceasefire and normalize all the actions they've got taken forward. Look, many FIFA members, by the way, in South America, that, you know, one of the biggest regions for football, might be attacked by this president between now and the next World Cup. What is FIFA going to do about that? Nothing. Because Gianni Infantino is aligning himself with this president and his political views just so he can share his spotlight. Now, you asked, what does it say to the people that, you know, people can't sit there, go down on one knee, or protest the ICE raids that are going on. Look, this has been America from day one, right? You and me know that. Like, it's just pigeoned differently, right? Whether it's Biden or Trump, a foreign policy, domestic policy, they try to always separate culture from actual change because they know the power that culture can bring. That's why they crack down so hard. And I'll give you another example because people are going to go hard at Trump. President Obama, during the BLM uprisings in 2020, could have changed the course of the country when he wasn't in office. The NBA were looking to him to ask him for his permission to strike, for his permission that black people wouldn't work or be entertainment for the white population during the BLM thing. And he told them not to strike. Remember that. This is consistent from all American presidents when it comes down to it. Some will not crack down publicly, but they will privately shut down any cultural revolutionary spirits that athletes have, that countries have, that other individuals have.
Well, Mr. Prashar, I'd like to thank you for pointing that out to our viewers who continuously need to be reminded sometimes about what history has shown us, and we don't want to just focus on today. Ms. Hatoum, let me move over back to you, and let's, of course, bring in Israel, the double standards and the geopolitics. Now, again, this is something we always have to pop up in any discussion. FIFA statutes prohibits the membership for entities that are not independent. Given Israel's control over movement, the infrastructure, and even the lives of the Palestinian footballers, how can the Israel Football Association even be considered independent?
Well, they're not independent. I mean, if you actually want to implement international law, the Israeli entity itself is not a state. It's still an entity because it doesn't have fixed borders. So technically, under international law, it's not a state. It's not independent at any point. They are a force of occupation. The place or the region is still under basically multiple what you call frictions and back and forth when it comes to wars. So if they want to implement international law on one side and not on the other, that clearly shows their double standards. That's one. The other thing, not suspending their team is another double standard versus basically the Russians whom they suspended directly. So if I look at the whole situation, I see a very corrupt group. And this is not the first thing that actually catches my eye. I mean, if you remember, FIFA was marred by all these scandals when it comes to taking bribes from Qatar, from other countries, when it comes to voting to certain members or appointing certain members. And some of them actually stuck to its leadership and its members. So at the end of the day, when you have a corrupt bunch ruling one of the highest bodies when it comes to the most popular sport in the world, one of the most popular sports in the world, that tells you a lot of things. They can be bought, they can be actually threatened with scandals, and they will have to implement double standards based on who holds their cards.
Well, exactly. Mr. Prashar, I do want to come over to you. Ms. Leila Hatoum did mention something for the second time. She mentioned Russia. And just a reminder of you from something we had put in our report, that in 2022, just 3 years ago, FIFA instantly removed Russia from the competition. The principle was clear. A member committing a severe breach of international law cannot use football as a platform. Now, this is their own wordings. This is their own statement. Why does this principle not apply again to Israel? Infantino himself says, quote, football cannot solve geopolitical issues. But wasn't banning Russia precisely an attempt to respond to such a geopolitical issue? I mean, isn't that considered picking a side, basically?
Well, there's so many questions there. I want to answer them all individually. So firstly, actually, FIFA and UEFA are pretty consistent. They didn't want to ban Russia. I want to make sure everyone understands this. 12 European countries, and this is where geopolitics does cut into this, led by Sweden and Poland, on the second day of Russia's invasion, when there was no clear war crimes, when there was just an invasion at that point, they called UEFA and FIFA and said they would boycott football. Now, as you know, Europe is the biggest moneymaker of football. 12 European nations, and they guaranteed another six were going to join, would basically shut down the global game, in essence. And they forced UEFA and FIFA into position where they can make those statements, where they're saying we're going to take this moral stand against Russia. But Infantino and Seferin didn't want to do that at that point. They only did this under the pressure of European governments, European sanctions, and European football federations that had a moral backbone for 5 minutes to do that. And the double standard actually is those same European federations, some who, by the way, say this in solidarity with Palestine, Ireland, Spain, Italy, countries like that, who basically abandoned Palestine here in this sense, right? Their public, their fans were threatening to boycott football, something that people do not do all the time. It is the global game. It is the number one sport in the world. Yet they were willing to do that for Russia, and they haven't done an ounce of that. And these are also, in Spain's case, a lot of good talk. A prime minister who says a lot of good things on TV. But if he boycotted football, think about that. They are the number one nation in the world with the best player in the world. Most people going to the World Cup want to see them, Argentina, Brazil. If they said they would boycott football tomorrow, FIFA would suspend Israel. If they said they'd boycott football tomorrow, they'd be out of the Champions League and out of UEFA overnight. They make so much money for UEFA. Now, answering the second point about that, geopolitics, sport has always been at the pinnacle of changing the world in geopolitics. Think about this, right? After World War II, the first things we not just not do we not just hold Germany accountable in Nuremberg and other war crime tribunals, but we banned them from international sport for 6 years. Nazi Germany and Germany West and East were banned for 6 years until the 1954 World Cup. Closer to home in Europe, Yugoslavia, during the Balkan War, was suspended from football and international competition. A war, by the way, that the UEFA president was personally involved in. He volunteered for the Slovenian army and witnessed atrocities, witnessed massacres of Bosnians, and has spoken about that repeatedly, about how culture had an impact. So the hypocrisy is really there, because they're trying to remove football and other sport from geopolitics and politics because it's become such a big business. Historically, sport has been at the forefront of isolating nations, committing war crimes, and punishing them and holding them accountable when they've committed crimes against humanity, like genocide, like apartheid. And the most popular, the biggest example is apartheid South Africa, where it isolated a nation and eventually brought it down.
Well, Mr. Prashar, I do, if you could please briefly answer your own question. You were saying how the human rights experts and people have been demanding and urging the boycotting of the Israeli football. Specifically, we have the 2026 Football World Cup coming up. Do you think that will happen? Why yes or no? Why?
Well, so look, as you guys know, as you've covered, we launched a campaign with Richard Falk, Craig McIver, other former UN High Commissioners, called Game Over Israel. And we never focused on FIFA. We have no intention of trying to get them thrown out of FIFA. The reality is, if you want to end Israeli football, you need to get them thrown out of UEFA. And I'll tell you why. Fundamentally, like Leila said, like you have introed, there's no way FIFA are going to kick Israel out of football. What, fundamentally, because they're aligned with U.S. foreign policy, and Gianni Infantino is so bent that everybody knows it at this point, right? He was actually Israel's pick for the job. UEFA, on the other hand, is where Israel plays 90% of its football. They play in the Champions League, the Europa League, the Conference League. Israel's federation is housed within UEFA, which is ironic given they're a Middle East nation. But also, their international competitions, the Nations League, the European Championships, that is where they make all their money. And here's the kicker. They also get a subsidy from UEFA to keep the league running. Because unlike the Premier League and La Liga, and this is not just a knock on the Israeli league. Like, no one watches Hungarian football internationally. No one watches Polish football. They get a subsidy from the big leagues who survive. And what we're trying to do with Game Over Israel, and what we think we will achieve in January, is UEFA actually suspending Israel, because we have run this campaign since September, and it's, you know, clear that Israel has no intention of following this fake peace plan that Donald Trump has. But also, legally, we are taking them to court in Switzerland, where they're in breach of international law, because they've actually encroached on Asian football territory by having occupied teams in the occupied territory participating in the Israeli Football League. Secondly, and this is good, unfortunately, it always comes down to money. UEFA only get a tax exemption in Switzerland if they continue to promote peace. Now, figure that. You get a tax exemption if you promote peace. Now, while Israel participates under the UEFA banner, and has teams in the occupied territory, they're in breach of their own tax exemption. And that is what we're going after.
Very interesting. Getting a tax when you promote peace, protesting at peace, and you get detained and arrested. There's so many things going on in this world. It's become insane. Ms. Hatoum, let's go ahead and take it a bit step further. I mean, the Palestinian footballers on the ground, they have been killed. Their stadiums have been damaged. Traveling just for matches has been made basically impossible. At what point can FIFA's inaction actually become complicity in this destruction and genocide?
Oh, it has been complicit since long time ago. I mean, remember, like, the whole attack against Palestinian footballers didn't start 2 years ago with this war, October 7, 2023, until today. It started way before, when the Israeli snipers were targeting the knees of Palestinian footballers on the ground, be it in Gaza or the West Bank. They were targeting future footballers when they were shooting little children in their knees as well. So at the end of the day, when you look at the whole situation, the Israeli occupation was practicing the act of taking out future football players and current football players at that time through sniping their knees. And FIFA didn't do anything. There were lots of complaints that were lodged, even by the PA itself. And PA is like, it lacks action at most of the time. And the FIFA and UEFA and anybody else, they didn't move. And I disagree with our colleague over here when it comes to possible action being taken in January. I don't see the Spaniards moving. The Spaniards actually promised to protect the flotilla at one point or another, and they actually didn't send their own navy to protect the flotilla. The Spaniards could have easily lodged a complaint to UEFA, and the La Liga is one of the biggest in UEFA, in Europe's basically federation for football, and they haven't done anything. The Italians, they're not going to do anything, and the Italian league is very big. When it comes to the French league is very big. They're not going to do any action against the Israelis. So who's left? The Irish are going to move anything? The Germans? I highly doubt that the Germans are going to take action. The Nazi Germany today basically supports the Zionist Israeli entity. That's why I call them the Zionazis and the Nazi Zionists. So at the end of the day, I highly doubt that there will be any action on a collective level from UEFA, but possibly from smaller countries within Europe. They could basically threaten and basically boycott playing games with the Israelis. I do bet that UEFA is going to actually implement fines on them and call them anti-Semitic itself.
Well, on that, we have a few more minutes left. I would like to go ahead and cross back over to Mr. Prashar. Mr. Prashar, I mean, ultimately, who is FIFA for? Is it for the global majority of players and fans who actually gather from around the world, no matter your nationality, no matter your culture, no matter your religion, just to sit, to enjoy a good match? Or has it actually become for the politicians, for the corporations it now so openly serves?
Firstly, I want to say I agree with Leila. I think football could have done something like they did for Russia. So I don't disagree. Spain, Italy, no, they're not going to do what they did against Russia. But What I want to say is that, unfortunately, because nobody's going to do anything, it is down to football fans, and it is down to the legal action and other things other people are taking behind the scenes right now to push UEFA over the edge. But FIFA's gone from the public. The game is gone. The game doesn't belong to the people anymore. Unfortunately, look, there is ways that the public can reclaim the game, right, and show their power, right? You're already seeing across Europe people protesting, demonstrating, showing tifos and banners in behalf of Palestine, everywhere from Istanbul to Paris to even in Germany, frankly, and they've been cracked down upon, but they still keep going. But the game, FIFA does, as an institution, is lost to the public at this point. It hasn't been that way since, I would go as far back as the 94 World Cup. The irony of that, the last time the Americans held the World Cup, was the beginning of the corporate decline of FIFA as an institution. After that, it became, you know, the home of politicians and Coca-Cola. And it will continue to go down that path unless the fans, frankly, reclaim the game and take this monstrosity back. But we see no willpower in people giving up the one, what I call their one escape from their normal life. That's the sad truth about it, especially for Westerners. They go to this game to vent. They go to this game to, like, escape from life sometimes, right? You think about conditions that people live in. I mean, you mentioned it. You know, even in the UK, you know, the quality of life right now is not great. And people go to a Liverpool game to escape that. Do you see them giving it up for a week or 2 weeks to change and can take back some power in football? No, FIFA is going to continue down the Americanization of this sport, similar to the NFL, similar to basketball, where it's become less about the fans, their experience, their relationship with the pitch and the game. And more about how much money they can rake in. Just look at the ticket prices. Some basic World Cup final ticket prices are $7,000. And there's no guarantee that even if you pay that, you won't be arrested, detained, and deported by ICE if you go to the United States.
Well, on that point, it seems I'm afraid we have run out of time. I'd like to thank both of our guests for joining us during this very interesting topic that definitely needs to be talked about more often. First of all, from New York, Mr. Ashish Prashar, political analyst and former West Asia Peace Envoy Advisor. And, of course, as always, from Beirut, Ms. Leila Hatoum, Editor-in-Chief of MENA Uncensored. A pleasure to have you both. Until next time, goodbye. We'll be right back.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering a doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman, Allah, who is Al-Mannan.
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. That is question and answer on Islamic beliefs. I am Ata, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi is over here from the Islamic House of Qom to answer today's question. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Are there other humans beside us in other places? I think the producers mean over here, the other planets or something like that. And or do other creatures besides human exist, and has a resurrection ever taken place or not? So even Islamically speaking, sometimes they say that we are born and we were created before in an alam called Alam al-Zar or something like that. So we were existing, and then we can say we were reborn into this world in our physical birth. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about the presence of the humans beside us in the other world or in the parallel world, maybe, Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So sometimes the question is about the past.
Yes.
I mean, are we the only generation of the human beings? Mm-hmm. Or before this generation, there might have been other generations of the human beings. And sometimes the question is about, the same time that we are living in. So if I like to answer the previous question, the first question regarding the past, as I mentioned in the previous program regarding the theory of the Darwin, there are two different theories about Darwinism. Some scholars believe in transformism or the theory of species evolution.
All right.
They believe that living species were not in their current form at the beginning, rather they originated as single-celled organisms in the ocean waters and emerging from the layers of sludge in the depth of seas through a mutation. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is one theory which is supported by the followers of Darwinism. But some scholars believe in the fixism or fixity of species, that each species of living beings appeared separately in its current form from the beginning.
Okay.
And we discussed in one of the first episodes regarding the viewpoint of Islam, regarding the theory of Darwin. And we mentioned that, first of all, the apparent meaning of many verses negate Darwinism, but some scholars refer to some verses to prove Darwinism, but it doesn't matter which viewpoint we follow. Whether we believe in Darwinism or fixism, it doesn't reject the Islamic interpretation of the creation of Adam, alayhi salam. Even if you believe in Darwinism, it might have happened that 10,000 years ago, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created Adam alayhi salam irrespective of the evolution of human beings.
Okay.
So having said that, if we believe in the theory of Darwin or Darwinism, we might believe that, there might have been different generations of the human beings coming to a point that they come to a final evolution of a human being.
Called the rational phase of the creation of human beings.
And as I mentioned, it can be in line with the Islamic interpretation of the creation of Adam alayhi salam.
All right.
Now, under this discussion, there are some narrations referring to the fact that before this generation, so we talk about Adam alayhi salam who came to this planet Earth maybe around 7 to 10,000 years ago.
Yes.
Okay. So the question is that, is he the only generation of human beings? No. The answer is negative. And whether we believe in transformism, evolutionism, or evolution theory, or fixism, it doesn't make any difference. Before Adam alayhi salam, there have been other generations of human beings. And this has been mentioned in some narrations from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, and this can be considered as one of the miracles of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, scientific miracles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 1,400 years ago, they refer to some scientific points that recently they have been discovered. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, for example, says that لقد خلق الله عز وجل في الأرض منذ خلقها سبعة عالمين ليس هم من ولد آدم. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created, from the time that he created the earth, he created seven generations of human beings, and they were not the offspring of Adam alayhi salam. فَأَسْكَنَهُمْ فِيهَا وَاحِدًا بَعْدَ وَاحِدٍ مَعَ عَالَمِهِ. So they began to reside on this planet earth, one after the other. Then later Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala creates Adam alayhi salam.
Right.
And we have similar narrations also in Khisal of Sheikh al-Saduq. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, addressing Jabir ibn Yazid, said that, do you think that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created only this world? And do you think that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has not created any other human beings except for you? No. I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that Allah has created 1,000,000 worlds, 1,000,000 worlds, and 1,000,000 human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And you are in the last generation of the human beings.
All right.
So the conclusion of the scientific discoveries and these narrations is that we are in the last generation of the human beings.
Okay.
Before us, there have been for sure, and the fossils that nowadays are discovered. I mean,
but this is in planet Earth, isn't it?
Yeah.
IRIB English Radio presents questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Answering your theological questions in questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Send us your questions to English Radio at irib.ir. Praises to Allah, all glory is to Allah.
We worship Allah and no one but Allah. Could it be possible that in the other worlds such a thing take place? Do we have any Quranic reference or hadith referring to the other planets of the universe?
So if I want to make a conclusion regarding the past, there for sure there have been other generation of human beings, but this generation that we are living in is the most perfect generation of human beings. So and also maybe today's scientific discoveries also prove that the previous generations of human beings, they were not as perfect as the generation that began with Adam alayhi salam.
All right.
Okay. So this is a very significant point that we need to take into consideration. As for other planets except for the Earth, also regarding our time, we do not have enough information, and that's a reality. Mm-hmm. Even today's scientific discoveries, they do not know exactly if there are other human beings living in other planets. Some narrations refer to different worlds, okay? And one may take from such narrations the message that there might have been other human beings in other planets, but the narrations are not very explicit in this regard.
Okay.
So the answer to this part of the question might be we do not know exactly if there are other human beings, other generations of human beings in other planets. both at our time and in the previous times. We do not know, maybe in the future.
Because in the recent discoveries, we can say they found that in the four planets, you know, which are very much the same to Earth, okay? Maybe 80% they are very much like Earth, okay? They have water or something like that. We still do not know, but there are some probabilities. And what about the jinns and the angels? They were for sure created before human beings, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this.
And I mean, when you say human beings, we are talking about the generation beginning with Adam alayhi salam. When Adam alayhi salam is created, the angels are already there. The jinns, at least some of them, they are already there because Satan is one of the jinn, and he was existent at that time. He did not prostrate before Adam. Meaning that before the creation of Adam alayhi salam, we have had both the angels and the jinns.
What about the previous generations of human beings? Was there a resurrection for them? I mean, before the creation of Adam?
Again, we cannot give a very decisive answer to this question, but it appears from the verses and the narrations that the answer is negative, and that is because of the fact that, as I mentioned, we are living in the last generation of the human beings and the most perfect human generation of the human beings. Maybe in the previous generations, people did not have enough intellect to receive divine revelations. Maybe they did not have prophets to guide the human beings. So many scholars, they have argued that when we talk about resurrection, we are talking about the time that people are taken into account because of their activities, because of their good and bad actions in this world. But prior to Adam alayhi salam, other generations of the human beings, they did not have enough capacity to receive divine revelation and divine instructions. And it is only the generation that which began from Adam alayhi salam in which people were blessed with, intellect, and then with receiving divine guidance through the prophets and the revelations.
Right.
And that is why they argue that, there has not been any resurrection for the past generation, and it will happen for this generation. But as I mentioned, this is just an assumption, and we cannot say that this is for sure the decisive answer to this question.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration regarding this question. The creation of human beings before us, before Adam alayhi salam, and was there a resurrection for these people or not? It was very kind of you, Sheikh.
My pleasure.
And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. Please, for more information, visit our website, iranradio.ir. To another episode, we leave you in Allah's care. Goodbye.
إن في الجنة نهرا من علي وحسين إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to all listeners of Iran Radio. Greetings to you wherever you are in the world. I'm Asma, your host for the next hour here in Tehran. We'll start this hour's lineup with a radio productions feature that will be followed by Leader's Speech. The program presents a selection of statements and speeches of the honorable leader of the Islamic Revolution. That will be followed by radio productions feature. After that, we have For Humanity, a variety of subjects from the Holy Quran, which predominantly tend to be social issues, are addressed in this program. Stay with us for the next hour.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we provide an in-depth analysis of the Zionist entity's criminal behaviour and the effort it puts into influencing international policymakers and global public opinion. In today's show, we'll be looking at Jeffrey Epstein's role in trying to damage the reputations of two esteemed academics, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. This was after they wrote a book about the pro-Israel lobby's disproportionate influence over US foreign policy. In our first report, Latif Arabachakra describes how Epstein, who was a Zionist asset, and the notorious Zionist lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, invented allegations of anti-Semitism against Mearsheimer and Walt.
Recently released emails of Jeffrey Epstein contain evidence that the convicted paedophile and Zionist intelligence agent collaborated with Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz to discredit the landmark 2006 study by Mearsheimer and Walt, titled The Israel Lobby. During the first week of April 2006, Epstein received multiple early drafts of an attack piece by Dershowitz titled Debunking the Newest and Oldest Jewish Conspiracy. Dershowitz, who also served as Epstein's defense lawyer, accused Mearsheimer and Walt of recycling discredited trash from neo-Nazi and so-called Islamist websites, accusing them of authoring a modern counterpart to the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Epstein responded to Dershowitz's email, "Terrific, congratulations." Later, Epstein received another message from Dershowitz's email address asking Epstein to help circulate copies of the attack. Epstein replied in the affirmative, "Yes, I've started." While Mearsheimer has spent his entire career at Chicago, his co-author Stephen Walt has been professor of international relations at the Harvard Kennedy School since 1999. Epstein was a powerful figure at Harvard. He had spent years cultivating relationships at the university, donating more than $9 million between 1998 and 2008. He positioned himself as a fixer and patron for high-profile academics, including Dershowitz and economist Larry Summers, who was the president of Harvard at the time, and recently apologized for his connections to Epstein. At the time, Epstein served as trustee and president of the Family Financial Office of Jewish billionaire Leslie Wexner. It donated nearly $20 million to the Kennedy School between 2000 and 2006. The Wexner Foundation's contributions underwrote core operating expenses. The foundation also funded a visiting scholar program, which allowed 10 Zionist regime officials to attend the Kennedy School each year for a one-year master's degree. Wexner is one of the most influential supporters of the Zionist colony. In 1991, he co-founded a philanthropic organization of Jewish billionaires known as the Mega Group, which uses some of its vast resources to support the genocidal colony. It reportedly had contacts with the Mossad and served as a vehicle for influence operations in the United States. Among its operations, it supported the creation of the Racist Birthright Israel program and the renewal of Hillel International, the Zionist student group, which now has over 1,000 branches including 50 outside of the US. In other words, Epstein's collaboration with Dershowitz connects the big players of the Israel lobby to attacks on the idea that there was a powerful Israel lobby. Walt, who still works at Harvard, declined to comment on these allegations. Mearsheimer said, "I'm not surprised to see these emails, because Dershowitz and Epstein were close, and both have a passionate attachment to Israel."
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. Our guest contributor today is the Palestinian author, poet, activist and political commentator Susan Abulhawa. Her first novel, Mornings in Jenin, was an international bestseller that was translated into 30 languages. Her other books include The Blue Between Sky and Water and Against the Loveless World. She also founded Playgrounds for Palestine in 2001 that upholds the right to play for Palestinian children. Welcome to the show. David, these emails from Jeffrey Epstein, I mean, they've seemed to be throwing up quite a lot of intriguing stories, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a lot of stories. We were discussing the attack on the Israel lobby this week, but there are many other stories about Epstein's role in geopolitics, essentially, in Côte d'Ivoire, in Africa, in Far East Asia, all sorts of involvement, of course, in line with Zionist intelligence aims and strategies, but much wider direct involvement than people have previously thought. Now, in relation to the Israel lobby thing, this is an indication, isn't it, that underlying the idea that Israel is only just an instrument of US imperialism is actually the Israel lobby saying, oh, it's not the Israel lobby. And that's the new thing about this particular story.
Yeah, is this just sort of a damage limitation exercise that they're going through?
Well, it's like, don't look at us, look elsewhere. And of course that helps. The left helped them with that by saying, oh, well, it's US imperialism, we shouldn't be looking at Zionism, we shouldn't use the word Zionist. So it's part of that kind of area of ideas, but it does indicate that many people on the left are effectively spouting Zionist talking points.
Yeah, kind of acting as sort of useful idiots, almost, you might say. But Susan, I mean, do you think we're beginning to get a better picture of the role that was actually played by Epstein?
Yeah, for sure. Epstein's operation is not likely to be the only one of its kind also. Zionists have used sexual coercion and sexual blackmail since before Israel was formally established even. And this is well known and documented, especially against Palestinians, but also against British officials during the mandate period. There's a book by Daniel Halper that credibly suggested that the Monica Lewinsky tapes were used to blackmail Bill Clinton in the 90s. Israel has used honey trap operations like this to kidnap Mordecai Vanunu, for example, the man who famously blew the whistle on Israel's nuclear program. And so Israel has a long history of these tactics, and Epstein's operation is par for the course, and it's not likely to be the only one. And the second thing to know about Epstein's operation is that it was never meant to be seen, rather, in the light of scrutiny. These tactics are meant to remain in the shadows, controlling politicians, policy, and so on, beyond public view. And the fact that this story is in the public consciousness now is an aberration of how things typically work with Zionist influence. What I can say with some certainty is that what we know, namely what has been released, is the tip of the iceberg. So in addition to focusing on what these emails reveal, I think we should also focus on what has been kept hidden, because ultimately the declassification of the current documents was meant solely to quell public outrage. It was never meant to inform or even reveal. So what we don't see, I believe, is far more important for transparency, and people should not stop demanding the full disclosure of